This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story?
Brooks, it's John Masserol and Tama Fulton. How are you?
Fantastic, thanks. I'm in Columbus, Indiana, so it's south of Indianapolis.
Are you speaking there, or what do you...
Tonight I have a community talk on resolving aggression in community, in the context of community, kind of schools and some local counseling organization, as well as some churches are all getting together to kind of give a lecture, so it's kind of neat.
Thank you so much for being a part of our podcast, True North Story. We offer motivation, inspiration...
Encouragement. And hope through the journeys of our guests. And I think that's really the unique part, is that it's not really so much about us, but really what we want is we want our guests to tell their story, pearls of wisdom and truth that has worked for them in their lives. And then our audience pick and choose what they want to incorporate into their own lives. The author, John Hart, has been a guest on True North Story, and we're friends, and I follow his feed and whatnot on Facebook. And that is where I first saw the video, when he posted your video on Facebook about the free speech and about words. And mm-hmm. It just blew me away, because as a writer myself, I thought words are so important. And your take on that was really powerful. So talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get into your background and kind of some of your childhood and how you've become who you've become. And we'll go from there. I wanted to kick it off so people could kind of get a feel for that, because that was 3 or 4 minute video was really, I thought, extremely powerful.
Well, thanks, man. I put out a video on Facebook called 10,000 Students Learn About Free Speech for the First Time. And it went viral. Almost 11 million people now have seen it.
That's amazing.
And I've gotten polarized comments, so many comments that are really polarized, either words do hurt or this is exactly right, words don't have to hurt. And really my premise for the whole talk and the premise for everything that I teach is we all know words can wound us. We all have been wounded by words. Anyone who tells you different is not in touch with reality. We don't need to teach people that words hurt. And that seems to be K-12, the only message that this generation is getting. Words hurt, words wound, words kill. But that's just a half truth. And if someone communicates a half truth and they avoid telling you the whole truth, they're really lying to you. They're withholding some truth. And the other part of the truth about words is that it can only cause subjective harm, meaning the words will wound you only if you allow them to wound you. The hurt is subject to what you think about those words, and that's critically important. Kill themselves over words may not understand or may have not been properly taught that they don't have to give those words power. And that's where the old sticks and stones slogan comes from. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And that's something we can tell ourselves to say, you know what, I'm going to school today. I'm going to work today. I'm going to face that enemy today who always tries to get me down with those words. But today, I'm not going to let those words hurt me. I'm not going to give them access to my emotions. And I'm trying to empower people with resilience, which is such an important skill, especially in this venomous viral age that we live in.
I worry so much that we're living in a society where instead of coping, if you want to, or having the emotional ability to cope, that we just shut down. Easier to say, I don't want to hear your opinion. I don't want to have to think critically about what you're saying. I don't want to have to defend what I believe. It's just easier to shut you down and say, no, you're a racist, you're a misogynist, you're a homophobe, and use those words to discredit you, as opposed to argue on the merits of the conversation and have an open dialogue where you can sort through the good, the bad, and the ugly.
I agree. I think it's maybe a result of the Twitter culture we live in, where we just throw these phrase bombs out there with no really ability to converse. 144 characters is not really dialogue.
No.
You know, that's why this format of a podcast like this is so refreshing, especially if you've got people with opposing viewpoints, because they're forced to really listen. And I always tell people, look, if you want to persuade someone to come on your side, if you want to reason with him, you know, one of the greatest old principles we used to teach in communication classes is listen. And before you seek to be understood, seek to understand. And whenever I communicate, you can stalk me on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, Instagram. Whenever there's opposition, which there is every day, like 50 times a day, when there's opposition, what I try to do is say, I hear what you're saying. It seems to me that you're concerned about people who are raped or murdered, or they have assault or battery, or they're having their stuff stolen or their property vandalized. This is what you're communicating, and you don't think love is the proper approach for criminals. I get it. But can I say this? I agree with you. In other words, I'm in agreement with you that we shouldn't, you know, enable people to commit crimes against us. However, love is much more dynamic than what you're thinking. Love, the loving thing to do to a criminal is to stop them with force if necessary, call the cops and throw their butt in prison. That's a loving thing to do. And so I allow myself to communicate with my adversary or my opponent, but I disarm them by finding something we can agree on and reflecting what they're trying to communicate. And if I can communicate what they're saying and articulate it better than them, wow. You know, I disarm them, and they say, yes, it's exactly what I'm saying, and then I can bring them around, hopefully, to my reasoning.
That's super interesting, and I like that. And that is a way to listen, is to actually hear the words that the person is expressing to you and repeat those words back to them so they know that they've been heard, and then continue to give them an alternative, which would be your viewpoint. Brooks, John and I often listen to a pastor out of Atlanta, Louis Giglio. Louis did a number of sermons on Psalm 23, and one of the sermons he did was on a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, talking about how there are enemies that are against us, against our beliefs, against our morals, and we can choose as people whom to invite to our table and whom not to. And I was wondering what your viewpoint was on that. Is there a point at which you say, I'm not going to engage, I'm not going to continue this, just need to agree to disagree, or do we want to continue to engage?
Yeah, I'm a fan of Lou Giglio. My favorite quote of his is describing what he calls worship, which is putting our heart's affection and our mind's attention on who God is and what he's done for us. And that's always helped me over the years. But Giglio's right if he's suggesting that there's a time to cut off the communication. I think so. You know, you can't, there's a lot of other proverbs that says if you rebuke a fool, you're going to get in return 100 blows back.
Mm. Right.
There's other wisdom things that say, why throw your pearls among swine? They're only going to be trampled. So I always look for the ability to listen. Do they have the ability to listen and hear me? And I also look for reasonability. Are they rational?
Right.
You know, or are they just making sweeping statements that I am a white supremacist, racist bigot or something?
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I can get through the name calling. Remember, I wrote a book on resilience. You can't hurt me. Okay. Yeah. Unless you punch my wife, then we're going to throw down.
Yeah, that's it.
If it's just line if in it's the just sand. Word, you know, feel free to call me whatever you want. I can get past your words, but am I able to have a reasonable, rational, logical, legitimate conversation where we can exchange ideas? And if not, then I'm not going to waste my pearls. I won't call them a swine.
Right.
I'll certainly withhold the pearls.
I think that's what Tam and I were talking. I mean, even for your own personal relationships in your own life. Because, you know, being around people that bring you down, whether you're trying to carry that weight in an optimistic way, it still has an impact on you. And it has impact on those that you are in relationship with as well. So if you're constantly reading your Twitter feed and people are just blowing you up and calling you all these horrible things, and even though, you know, to your point earlier about, you know, understanding that words only have the weight that you assign to them, it's still, it's a drag, man. It's a drag to go down your feed and they're calling you all these things. And these, and most of these people don't have credibility, to your point. If you're looking and they're not arguing or they're not defending or they're not adding critical information about why they believe or why you're wrong or where there's areas of potential discussion, areas where you might have things in common, areas where, then if they're just throwing negativity and verbal bombs, you know, I kind of look at it like they don't have any credibility anyway. And so, to your point, you don't want to call them swine, but they're certainly not worthy of your time.
Right. And I'm under no delusion that words cannot sting. I'm fully aware of that, especially the closer you are to the person, the more affection you have to them, or the higher of position of authority they have and influence over your life, their words are going to carry weight. I am saying, there's a proverb that says, above all else, guard your heart. Out of that heart flows all the issues of life. And if you find yourself having issues, it's because you've allowed your heart to be exposed to the fiery darts of your enemies, to the people who want to see you fall and fail, or you have put too much weight in the words of others. Now, I also have to balance it with this truth. Criticism can actually take you higher if you have an ear to learn, if you have a teachable spirit. I love criticism. I learn the most from those who criticize me. And it hurts. It stings. Man, before I ever click the Facebook app or whatever, or before I check how many comments do I have today, I have my heart kind of palpitates a little bit. And,
for sure.
And I kind of have this self-talk that says, look, is there continuity in what these people are saying? If they, for example, in that speech that went viral, I say, we live in a democracy. Now, that is a true statement, but it's not completely true, because I've had about at least 3,000 people say, you're an idiot. We don't live in a democracy. We live in a constitutional republic.
Right.
But we'll do your research. I was listening to you the whole time until you said that.
Hey, Brooks, those must have been the Mark Levin followers.
Hello? Hello? That is such crap.
So, dude, the first thing I did was link them to an article, like from the Washington Post or something, that said, do we live in a democracy or a republic? And both are true. It's like telling German Shepherds, you're not a canine, you're a German Shepherd. We're talking about umbrella words that become hyper-niche to help clarify the type of democracy we live in, representative democracy. But you can't reason with these people. But I realized, though, that almost 3,000 comments, right? There was over 250,000 shares of that particular video. And I'm not exaggerating when I say 3,000 comments were rebuking me because I said we live in a democracy. Though I am technically right, as a communicator, I realize I'm wrong. They shut down my message because I said a trigger word. It's like me as a speaker, if I fail to help my audience listen to what I have to say because of a choice word that I used, I fail. So you know what? I'm not doing that anymore. I'm never going to say we live in a democracy ever. And I just put one massive apology to everybody. Back to the point is, sometimes we need to view the words of our enemy as the words of our best friend. And it's our best friends that tell us hard truths. Faithful are the wounds of a friend rather than the kisses of an enemy, which are deceitful. So even if my enemy is slugging me, I'm going to say, is there any truth? David did this when he was on some road escaping because his son Absalom took over the kingdom, and someone came up to him and started cursing him, and one of his mighty warrior men said, let me cut this guy to pieces. And David says, no, there might be some truth in what he's saying, and maybe God just rose him up to rebuke me so I could stay humble. And we need to have that attitude. Let me hear your criticism, because your passionate words against me are the sound of liberty. Let me hear what you got to say. Hit me with your best shot. I might learn from it.
Well, and here's a really interesting point that just fits into that. I just read an article today. I think it was from a credible source. I mean, it's really difficult to sort through sometimes all the information and social media and making sure that you can backtrack it to be factually accurate. But there was an article I read this morning that Amazon had removed almost 1,000 negative reviews about Hillary Clinton's book on their site. And when they were approached by several media outlets why this was the case, because it significantly changed the rating, they said that comments were not pertinent to the actual book itself, but they were more that the comments were about her or her candidacy or her presidential run and things like this, and that they weren't directly relatable to the book. So they therefore threw them out. But that's almost 1,000 reviews. And I just thought to myself, as you were making the point about taking ownership for your choice of words, and do you think technology magnifies that to a point where it's like we get so myopically focused on the wrong things? It's like, shouldn't we be concerned about what people think about the book? Like, if we're going to make our decision about based on what reviewers are saying, hey, you know, it was honest, it was truthful, it was insightful, she really told us what the inside story was about her campaign, we ought to be able to have that. Like, is Amazon really in a position to filter? And unless it's just hate or something like that, what do you think on that, Brooks?
Yeah, I do know that the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which gives us this freedom of speech and ultimately expression and religion, it really is only written that the government shall not make any law that would hinder our ability to express ourselves in speech. But when it comes to private companies, they have every right to do whatever they want on their platform. So that's where the rub is.
Right. You know, you've got Google and you've got Facebook and you've got Amazon and you've got Apple. Oh, I mean, which you could argue are pretty much monopolies. I mean, you know, yes, I mean,
they are
right.
They are monopolies. You know, they're bigger than the size of countries combined.
Right.
So we have this sense, this, and even in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, there's freedom of speech. So even the global community agrees with this concept that we should not keep people from having the ability to freely think and freely speak within reason, that the speech does not incite violence, and it does not slander or libel people, you know, hurt them from having their own liberties, like getting a job and whatnot. As long as liberties are not taken away from other people with your speech, you're free to speak. But I don't have a problem with a company playing speech police, because it really is their platform and they can do whatever they want. Am I bummed? Totally.
Right.
You know, I've had friends who have incredible YouTube videos from like PragerU.
Yeah.
And a third of them are all off. They're not even allowed. And it's like, how is that even fair? That's not cool, man.
Or they get demonetized. That's the other thing, YouTube, you know, and all of a sudden,
right,
like, you're not. Well, and I agree with you. I mean, I'm a capitalist, too. And I think your infrastructure, you built it out. It's your organization. I just think that most Americans think as long as it's fair, as long as it's equal, even Steven on either side, I think most people would have no issue with that. But if it's skewed to one viewpoint or one ideology or, you know, anti-religion, pro-secularism, or vice versa, I mean, I think most Americans would have a problem with that. We just want to believe in fairness.
I agree, but these are humans. These are all ran by individuals. And we all aggregate towards our own like-minded community.
Right, our tribe.
Know, segregation is not a terrible thing. It's literally survival. You know, we only have so much space for certain people in our lives, and we like to surround ourselves with like-minded people. And that's how these boardrooms of these big companies are. So I think the American people need to just find other platforms to speak out on if they're shut down. And hey, that's okay. That's why I love podcasts like this. Unless, of course, Apple shuts us down because of the content of our conversation.
Learn, love, listen, live. This is True North Story, the original podcast series. And now, back to the program. I get the feeling you're trying to tell me. Is there something that I should know? What excuse are you trying to sell me? Should I be reading stop or go? I don't know.
Well, Brooks, let's take a little bit of a turn and let's go back to a baby Brooks. and find out a little bit about your childhood growing up. What kind of a family were you part of? Because you speak to schools and students about bullying and words and empowering them to treat others as you would like to be treated, your golden rule. What was your early childhood and your elementary and junior high years like?
Well, I appreciate the question. I don't want to bore people, so I'll give you the really fast version of it. I'll tell you, and I'll skip decades here. I'll start with my very first memory, which is my parents behind the closed door screaming at each other. And I was in a playpen, so I could have been two or something like that.
Holy cow.
And my dad came out, and he had like blood down his like forehead, and he was looking in the mirror. I guess my mom had scratched him, and they got essentially a very physical, violent encounter.
Wow.
And my father left. And my second memory is when I was about three, I think, and I was standing at the door of our little duplex, and when my mom and sister, older sister, were next to me, and we watched my dad pack up his car and he drove out of our lives. So I have a very traumatic, scary, single parent,
good
broke
grief.
As a joke, early childhood memory, which really shaped deep insecurities, unfortunately, that I had to overcome. Fast forward to middle school, my dad comes back into my life, and I leave my mom's house, and I live with my dad, and he's, at that point, had been married three additional times, divorced three times, and he was kind of a womanizer and alcoholic. And when I lived with him throughout all middle school, he'd drink 30 beers a day.
Whoa.
30 beers a day.
He'd
start in the morning with coffee, and then he'd have two iced teas, and then he'd drink. And even when he traveled and did a little business, he was a functional drunk. And I was abandoned quite a bit in middle school, and that's when the worst, what you don't talk out, you act out. That's when the worst actions, I would cut myself, I would be depressed, I experimented with drugs and hanging out with the wrong people. And I remember my mom visiting me at the end of my eighth grade year. She hadn't seen me for a long, long time. And somehow she came and picked me up from school, and we talked, and she looked at me, and she said, I feel like I'm going to lose you. I was in special education courses. I couldn't be mingling with the regular population because of emotional and outbreaks of anger and just a victimization mentality I had. It was terrible. She said, you know, Brooks, this is the start of the transformation. She says, you know, Brooks, not everyone's going to like you, and not everyone's going to want to be your friend. I said, Mom, you need to be more positive. She says, she's sassy. She said, I'm positive not everyone's going to like you, and I'm positive not everyone's going to want to be your friend. And she says, the sooner you get that and you're happy with the one or two friends you do have and you stop living for the approval of others and you stop expecting your father to be like a good dad to you, when you start taking personal responsibility for your own feelings and stop blaming all your problems on others, you know, that's the only way you're going to snap out of this funk. And so between her hard, tough love and also my sister, who at that time was about 16 years old, and she took me to her youth group, and they were teaching about, you know, the teachings of Jesus, love your enemies, and do good to those who hurt you and spitefully use you. Between my mother's tough love and my sister's teachings, reflecting Jesus' teachings, I crawled out of the deepest, darkest season of my life. And people say, well, how does that connect with what you do today? You mm-hmm. know, I've given over 1,500 paid speeches, over 2 million teenagers. I've looked face in the face, you know, over 25 million virtually through videos and stuff. Well, here's what it is. If you listen to me talk, I'm addressing the victim mentality. The worst acts of violence are created by people who feel like victims. They either hurt others in retaliation, their enemies, or they hurt themselves because they see no light at the end of the tunnel. They commit suicide. Hmm. It's not bullies or perpetrators we should be afraid of as much as it's victims. A lot of those perpetrators are victims. That's the scariest complex, and it's the most miserable. I interact with quite a few activists, and I've never met a happy activist, basically because they're not able to compartmentalize their fight or their cause. They allow the victimization to bleed into every other area of their life, and they're miserable beings. You know, we're allowed in this nation to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and sometimes we think that activism is the way. Once we get this resolved and we get this restitution for our people, then we'll find happiness. But what you find out is you have nothing but a life of bitterness and poison, and you're miserable to be around. So I'm really trying to liberate victims, because I was one, and I saw how evil it took over my life, how deep and dark my life was, that I just say, you know what? We got to be resilient. We got to see the positive and the bright parts of life. My wife is a quadriplegic. I married her in a wheelchair. One of the most attractive things that drew me to her was her love of life. Here she was, trapped, a prisoner in her own body from a gymnastics accident, and you'd think she'd be depressed and mopey, but she was a world traveler. She, you know, I met her in college, and she was just the life of the party, and her favorite life verse was, this light affliction is just for a moment, but it's working in me a far and exceeding eternal weight of glory. And I thought, girl, that is hot. That is hot. You're so beautiful. And that's all resilience is. Resilience is leveraging adversity for psychological growth. And if victims can realize that the very thing that they have been victimized from can be the greatest thing that's ever happened to them, if they could leverage it for psychological growth, then we could see so much less misery and so much more advancement in a lot of areas in life.
Brooks, how did that transformation go for you? Obviously, it was an aha moment there with your mom in eighth grade. What was the process of becoming the Brooks that you are today between eighth grade and, say, college?
Sure. Well, I'd say 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. That was the season. That was the season where I could flesh out this philosophy of no longer victimized, not allowing other people to victimize me with their words. You know, I live in a society that has cops, so no one's going to just come up to me and try to beat the crap out of me. They might try to provoke me to a fight, or they might try to provoke me with their words or their pushes and shoves. But to answer your question, it was the high school years that I fleshed this out, and I realized, wait, I really am in control. And people say bullying is the worst thing that ever happened to, like, kids today. And I'd say, no, bullying or dominance behavior or social aggression, whatever, I hate the word bully, but social aggression, whether it's in siblings at home or if it's among peers at school, it's an opportunity for two things. Number one, to measure the emotional resilience of a child to see how weak they are for the real world. And number two, to start working out their social skills. You know, we can't develop resilience unless we have adversity. You can't develop resilience in a child by protecting them. You have to expose them to some level of adversity to measure their level of resilience and to help them grow in their resilience. So between a therapist and my mother's, I moved in with my mom full time all throughout high school. We really focused on my ability to endure the hostilities of a 3,000-member public high school. That was so good for me because I failed many times. I cried many times. I was provoked into a fight many times. But I remember one rumor was spread about me in junior high school. That was kind of true. But it totally humiliated me. And so I was challenged, but my mother was always there, and good mentors in my life. It's like this. They say, Brooks, we're not going to solve this problem for you, just like we wouldn't solve all your math problems or all your biology problems. Like, we're going to be by your side, but you got to struggle with this for yourself and solve this on your own. That's the only way you can develop self-confidence, self-worth, self-esteem. All three words have self in common. We can't do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. And so they were on my side, but in my face, saying, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. That's what I try to teach educators today. Don't rescue kids. Educate them, okay? You're not a police officer. You're a teacher. So do what you were trained to do. Teach them how to leverage this adversity with this peer. And for psychological growth, for social skill development, that's what we need to be doing.
I absolutely love that, because I think that we are in a place where it's more about making the adversity go away than it is dealing with it. or leveraging it, to use your terminology, which I absolutely love, because it's like it can just make the adversity go away, then you don't have to deal with it, and life is sunshine and lollipops and everything is good, but it doesn't give younger people any coping skills. And that is where, to your point, bad things start to happen, potentially.
Yeah, millennials are not prepared for the real world. That's why you've got these college students crying foul every time they hear anything that might offend them. Not only are we losing the value of the democratic right to free speech in our constitutional republic that we live in, not only are we losing these values of free speech and liberty, but we're losing the skill to compete on the global level. To say, man, look, adversity, resilience is not about bouncing back from adversity. When I use the word leverage, I really mean it. It's yeah. actually leveraging the adversity to blaze forward, where I look at my life and I say, I'm so glad I went through that. And if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't change a thing. Now, listen, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
Right.
But it did happen. And I am so much more compassionate and empathetic towards other people who go through the same thing. I'm much more careful about how I treat people or how I project, you know, my life right. on others so I don't wound other people. I have so much more experience and a wealth of knowledge. I wouldn't change a thing. And you'd hear that from my wife. Jill, you're a quadriplegic. Do you wish you skipped that gym practice that one day when you took a wrong backflip and you broke your neck? Do you wish, you know, she said, of course, I wish that didn't happen. But I see so much value in it. My disability, and that's what Paul, right. if you're a Bible person, Paul says, I don't boast in my education or my birthright or my heritage. I boast in my affirmities. It's those things that make me who I am. And I love that about me. I'm proud of who I am and what I've overcome. I want people to embrace the hurt and grow from it.
And that's like one of the things that Tam and I are all about, the journey, right? And that's all part of your story. And it's what makes you unique. And it's what makes you who you are. And I just think that the millennials, to a certain extent, are missing out on so much about their own story. Like, I remember my dad was old school. Tama knows my dad. And God bless him. God. The man was the smartest man I've ever known in my life. But he used to tell me, there was a lot of things he told me, but one thing that always pops up was always like, whoever told you life was going to be fair? Whoever told you life is supposed to be fair? Life isn't fair. Get over it. Deal with it. You know what I mean? You're one of millions and millions of people that live in this world. You know, we're living in this world where I don't think people think they have this warped view that everything is supposed to be a certain way. And I'm not even sure they can tell you why they think that, other than they've been maybe indoctrinated by academia and other places to believe this. But it's like, life isn't fair. You got to deal with it.
I think you can trace it from a sociological, anthropological perspective. Anthropology is, you know, of course, the study of human behavior in groups over time. And if you go back to 1999, April 20th, Columbine, where the shooting happened, and I lived in Littleton, actually. My friends went to Columbine.
Wow.
And that
wow.
was the birth of the anti-bullying movement. The guy that wrote the foreword to my book, Craig Scott, one of my closest friends, his
Rachel
sister
Scott.
Rachel was shot.
Yes.
Yeah. And these are all my friends and my people, and I remember seeing the birth of the anti-bullying movement happen right before my eyes in Littleton, Colorado. That's actually where I met my wife. That's where I started my career. I graduated that same year, a different school, but when I look back at that, everyone was wondering, how do we keep victims like Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold? Yes, I said victims. How do we keep them from retaliating in such violence and hurting themselves? Remember, I said the worst acts of violence are created by those who feel like victims. Mm-hmm. And as we learn more about the life of Eric and Dylan, we realize as they left journals behind and videotapes, that was retaliation. They were bullied, as the term goes. They were humiliated. They were ostracized. They were excluded from social groups. They were picked on and teased and tormented by other people. And they allowed that to grow. And, you know, together, they just were in a downward spiral. And so the legal community came together with the mental health community, and they said, how are we going to keep tragedies like this from happening again? And everyone agreed, we have to address the victim mentality. And so there was really two routes that you could go. The mental health professional said, let's empower children with the skills they need to not be victimized, because this is just subjective harm. This is not objective harm. When someone calls you a name, it's not giving you a black eye. It just hurts your feelings. So let's equip them so they're not even hurt in the first place. And the lawyer said, nah, it's like soft science. No, let's legislate niceness, essentially. And let's just make sure that no one is called a bad name or ostracized for any reason. And I'll tell you what, if you get a lawyer and a psychologist together in a ring to duke it out, the lawyer will always win, because science submits to law or it goes to jail. And so when you take a legal approach to social problems, you escalate hostilities, you make things way more complex, and the legal community not only messed up our efforts to empower victims, not only totally jacked with social sciences, with these anti-bullying laws, but they distracted us, and they gave us this word bully. And now we're using a judgment term like slut, jerk, or loser. We're giving people labels, which are black and white, guilty, bully, innocent, victim. And that's not even how conflict works. You know, anyone who has kids knows, well, who started it? Well, I don't know. She called him this because he called him that, and he did that because he called him that. You know, when you take a legal approach, you mess things up. And so I think we have now, I think it's been 18 years or 17 years since Columbine. We now have an entire generation that has seen anti-bullying laws enforced, or the schools are not getting funding. And they are conditioned to believe that no one has the right to say anything mean to me, because words hurt, words wound, words kill. And now we created unfortunately, an emotional welfare state where children actually believe that the government is responsible to remove the mean people from their lives and to give restitution to accommodate their insecurities or sensitivities. That's why we're in the mess. And I believe it had a huge ramp up with Columbine. I saw it with my own eyes.
I don't disagree with anything you said. I don't think Tama would either.
That's so interesting. And it's been, you're right, nearly 20 years.
Yeah. What do you see as the way out?
Well, I think education is. The cool thing about resilience, it's unlike physical resilience. Emotional resilience is not like physical resilience. Physical resilience, if you play guitar, you know the only way that you can build up physical resilience is by causing pain to your fingertips until they callus over. Well, thank God emotional resilience is nothing like that. You don't have to expose a child to repeated humiliations for them to finally get it. It really is education. It's teaching a child, look, we're all wired for reciprocity. When someone's mean to you, I bet you have something inside of you that wants to tear their head off, right? And the kid says, yes. You're like, that's the law of reciprocity. And when people are nice to you, you have really good feelings inside, don't you? And they're like, yes, how'd you know? It's like, well, because that's just the way our bodies are wired. But here's the thing. Every time they call you a mean word, okay, they're trying to evoke out of you a negative reaction. And if you get it, they have the satisfaction. So when you realize that you could guard your heart, you don't have to give them what they want. And in fact, if you get upset, they win, you lose. But if you don't get upset, you win and they lose and they go on to somebody else. So if we educate them how aggression works from a biological, neurological, we educate them how it works, how to possess their body, and give them simple, you could call it soft skills, simple social skills. We just educate, and that's what I'm doing, because at some point a mom has gone to the school and said, if you don't stop the mean behavior from happening to my child, I'm going to move schools. Okay, we'll report it, we'll investigate it, we'll suspend them. We'll do all these external measures to try to create a bubble around your child. At some point, that child realizes none of that's helping. And then the mom says, well, what do I do? She searches online. How could I help my kid? And then she finally gets advice from podcasts like this, videos like mine, blogs by school psychologist Izzy Kalman and others who are educating the public online, saying maybe the perfect person who's positioned to help your child is your child. So let's equip them with resilience so that they're not even offended in the first place, and social skills to disarm the people that are mean to them. So I think the answer is using modern media, not legislation, modern media to communicate with superior education that makes sense to the people looking for it.
Where does the term boundaries come from, and how do you utilize that, Brooks, with talking with kids and adults?
I guess Dr. Henry Cloud coined the term with John Townsend in his book Boundaries. But
is that something to have in your toolbox?
Absolutely. You know, I teach my little ones, this is my body from my toes to my top, and I say, no, you better stop. And these are kind of anti-predator approaches. You know, how do we protect their body from physical harm? But I think boundaries is talk in the home to simply say this: look, you can only control how you react or respond. And when Big Brother loves to drive you crazy and you really get upset, it's a cyclical downward spiral process. Any parent knows this. One kid loves to bother. The other kid is easily bothered. So when I talk about boundaries with children, I would say, do you want peace with your brother? Do you want peace here at home? I know we want it. Yes, I want. Do you want to be friends? Then stop getting satisfaction at driving him crazy. And then in another private conversation, I go to the little kid and I say, stop getting so easily bothered. Don't you realize he's controlling you? I think any time a child has a problem, boundaries is discussed when we say, what can you control? And if it's talking about subjective activity, which is just, you know, stuff that happens internally in me, or objective activity, something that happens externally to me, boundaries has to adjust based on the behavior that we're talking about. And giving children the ability to discern objective harm, which is rape, murder, physical assault, stealing, things like objects, or subjective harm, my feelings, giving them a very clear boundary of clarity, what's a crime and what is my responsibility to control, helping them understand that distinctive helps them understand what to do once they feel victimized.
Brooks, if people want to engage with you, they want to have you as a speaker, they want to read your book, they want to watch some of your videos, how do people find Brooks Gibbs?
Yeah, just add a .com to the name, brooksgibbs.com, and that'll point you in all the directions needed, or just Google my name, Brooks Gibbs. I think I always like to leave people with love. You know, there's in 1 Corinthians 13, it says love is two things. Love suffers long, and love is kind. And so love is, another word for it, is resilient. If you look at the actual original text of that poem in 1 Corinthians 13, love is resilient, it has tough skin, and it's kind, it has a tender heart. And that's the balance we want, not only to have for ourselves, but for our loved ones. And never give a one-sided message. Oh, love suffers long, which means then you're just tough skin and you're harsh towards others. That's not balanced. And it's not balanced to be tender and say, love is always soft and kind all the time. Well, then you're going to be weak as water. You need tough skin and the tender heart. You need those two things to balance out a whole person to endure in this very hostile world. If we do that, if we teach love, kindness, but tough kindness, tough love, then I think we'll prepare people for this harsh new world.
Thank you so much, Brooks. We have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I know there is so much truth packed in here that our audience, and I hope everyone that listens to this and shares it, will really, really benefit tremendously from your insight and your passion and your knowledge. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, John Tama, love y'all. Thank you so much for your hard work and your dedication to grow this audience. It was an honor to be on your platform.
Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.